Chapter 12. Muhammad Iqbal, Pakistani poet inspired by Quranic motifs, 1935 CE. Poets achieve fame not just in their lifetime, but across generations. For many Muslims, especially those of India and Pakistan, who seek a contemporary counterpart to Rumi, the most obvious candidate would be Muhammad Iqbal, 1873 to 1938. A Kashmiri, a Punjabi, an Indian, a Pakistani by adoption, Iqbal combined competing identities. But above all, he was a visionary poet whose vision was framed by the Quran. Iqbal was born into a devout Muslim family in 1873. His ancestors were Hindus from Kashmir. Though Brahmins, they had converted to Islam during the reign of Shah Jahan. Iqbal's family later moved from the Kashmir Valley to the plains of the Punjab, where he received a thorough education that was both religious and secular. He loved Arabic for the great works of literature and philosophy that it opened up to him, but above all for the resonance of the Quran. He wrote poetry from an early age. It took him into another realm, the realm of the imagination, helping him to engage with the change of fortune that confronted him and his fellow Muslims. By the turn of the new century, the worldly fates of Indian Muslims had become very sad. Mughal glory had been superseded by British rule. In 1905, Iqbal went to England, obtaining his law degree at Cambridge University. He also continued to study literature, and at the behest of one of his English professors specializing in Persian literature, he later went to Germany. In Munich, he earned his doctorate before returning to India at the age of 35. Though he practiced law for a living, it was poetry that animated him. It gave meaning to his life and earned him high renown. At first, he wrote verse in Urdu, but then switched to Persian, while still writing some lyrics in Urdu. In both languages, he tried to merge the modern world with the Muslim aesthetic tradition, weaving new ideas into the many, many poems he composed. In his poetry, Iqbal exhorted people, particularly the young, to stand up and face life's challenges boldly. The central theme and main source of his message was the Quran. He considered the Quran to be much more than a book of religion or scripture. It was for him a source of foundational principles upon which to build a coherent system of life. The result was Islam. If Islam were based on the permanent, absolute values given in the Quran, reasoned Iqbal, it would bolster collective and individual, public and private identity. It would undergird perfect harmony, balance, and stability in the public sphere, at the same time that it provided freedom of choice and equal opportunity for individuals in the private sphere. Everyone could and should develop his or her life within the guidelines of the Quran. The Quranic way eschewed both rank individualism and collective tyranny. It ruled out a private, subjective relationship with God that accented personal salvation, but equally it debarred theocracy, rule in the name of God, and dictatorship, rule through brute power. Tyranny, whether religious or secular, countermanded the free spirit of Islam announced and promoted in the Quran. Because Iqbal was a poet-philosopher, his goal was to marry dialogue to dialectics in a way that neither the Greeks nor their modern successors had done. In the Quran, Iqbal found the model for a dialogue between God and man. It was continuous and multivalent. It began with man's complaint. In 1909, after returning from Europe to India, Iqbal chanted the complaint before a gathering of fellow Muslims. His soft voice and gentle rhymes belied the stark message. Modern Muslims do have a complaint against God. It is a legitimate complaint framed by the trust of centuries, stretching back to the time of the Prophet. It is put at risk now, bemoaned Iqbal, by the despair of present-day circumstances. We, Muslims, blotted out the smear of falsehood from the pages of history, we freed mankind from the chains of slavery. The floors of your Kaaba with our foreheads we swept, the Quran you sent us we clasped to our breast. But now your blessings are showered on homes of unbelievers, strangers all. Only on the poor Muslim does your wrath like lightning fall. It was not Iqbal's intent to reject God or belief in God with this lament, but many of the religious people of his time saw it differently. They accused him of taking liberties in addressing God so frankly. His manner, they groused, was more that of a drunken Sufi like Rumi than that of a sober scholar like Tabari. Iqbal pondered these responses. He also imagined what might be the response of God to his complaint. 4 years later, in 1913, in his home city of Lahore, at the mosque built by the Mughal Emperor Shah Jahan, the same mosque where Sir Syed Ahmad Khan had spoken less than 2 decades earlier, Iqbal delivered God's answer to the complaint. All you drink the wine of bodily indulgence, leading lives of ease without strife. Dare you call yourselves Muslims? What kinship of the soul can there be between your ancestors and you? As Muslims, your forefathers were honored and respected. But you gave up the Quran and now by the world are rejected. The human, divine dialogue did not come easily to Iqbal. It burned his soul. Raw and stark, it imitated the arduous quest of Sufi masters from the Islamic past. Yet he challenged the present age to produce its own spiritual risk-takers, those who would dare to intercede on behalf of others, seeking God's blessing and pursuing knowledge of his will. To this ancient dialogic form, familiar if not always acceptable to all Muslims, Iqbal brought a new content. His quest was to bridge Islam and the modern world without supporting colonialism or embracing atheism. As he said in another poem, echoing one of his favorite Quranic themes, Abraham in the Fire, chapter 21, verse 68 through 69, I broke the spell of modern learning, I took away the bait and broke the trap. God knows with what indifference, like Abraham, I sat in its fire. As the fire of nationalism swept through India, stirring Muslims as well as Hindus and Sikhs, Iqbal tried to provide the answer to Abraham's dilemma. He eventually provided the answer not in verse, but in prose. In 1928, he gave 6 lectures to Muslim students in Madras that were then published in a book entitled Reconstruction of Religious Life in Islam. In it, Iqbal unfolds the Muslim past in the dialogic space of the European present. With the Quran as his litmus test, he critiques his intellectual ancestors. While Greek philosophy very much broadened the outlook of Muslim thinkers, he laments, it on the whole obscured their vision of the Quran. Yet the greatest of modern European thinkers, trying to wed science with progress, have also lost their way in the cosmos. Modern man, that is, modern European man, observes Iqbal, has ceased to live soulfully, that is, from within. To reconstruct religious life in Islam, one must first relocate, grasp, and celebrate life from within, the experience of the other as a dimension of everyday life. Iqbal uses both the Quran in Arabic, a book of signs, and the Quran in Persian, Rumi's Mathnawi, to frame the arguments of reconstruction of religious life in Islam. His goal is to find Muslim sources which can counter the challenge posed by European thinkers as well as colonial overlords. The Noble Quran and Maulana's Mathnawi are the riposte to European luminaries, from Charles Darwin and Sigmund Freud to Bertrand Russell and Albert Einstein. With the reawakening of Islam, writes Iqbal, it is necessary to examine, in an independent spirit, what Europe has thought and how far the conclusions reached by her can help us in the revision and, if necessary, reconstruction of theological thought in Islam. Because European social initiatives and technical achievements have benefited all humankind, one must apply a pragmatic test even to divine revelation. To the extent that the Quran confirms for modern man the eternal value of Gabriel's message to the Prophet Muhammad, it is because the general empirical attitude of the Quran engendered in its followers a feeling of reverence for the actual, and ultimately made them the founders of modern science. Even as he was delivering these lectures in 1928, Iqbal seemed to recognize that he had let the jinn, or as English speakers would say, the genie, out of the bottle. Though never citing Sir Syed Ahmad Khan by name, Iqbal was confirming that a new science of religion had to have an empirical strategy that conformed to modern science. As a result, however, the trust of God to humankind was no longer a book apart from other books. It was a book that stood tested and confirmed on the anvil of modern science, with its rules of evidence, its guidelines, and its protocols. At the same time, science was divinized, embraced as the handmaiden of God. Its rules were deemed to be His rules, its world His world. For the modern Muslim, as for their ancestors, the challenge was the same. Never cease dialoguing with God. The question raised by modern science was the same question raised in every age. Whose authority is it that makes and shapes the world? Whose world is this, yours or mine? Was how Iqbal formulated the query in one of his most haunting poems, published in 1935, just 3 years before his death. The wing of Gabriel compressed meaning into sound, and made of the sound an echo that lingers. It was as though Iqbal the philosopher could only come to terms with the tragic separation of humanity from its divine source through verse. Whose world is this, yours or mine? On the morning of eternity, Satan dared to say, no. But how would I know why? Is Satan your confidant or mine? Muhammad is yours, Gabriel is yours, the Quran is yours. But this discourse, this exposition in melodious tunes, is it yours or is it mine? Your world is illuminated by the radiance of the Star of Adam. But whose loss was the fall of Adam, that creature of earth? Was it yours or was it mine? The key word of this poem is loss. The loss is occasioned by Adam's fall, so graphically told in the Quran. And when we told the angels to bow to Adam, they bowed, except Iblis, the one who despaired. He refused, showing arrogance, and he was a scoffer. And we said, Adam, dwell in the garden, you and your wife, and eat from it comfortably, when and as you want. But do not approach this particular tree, lest you become wrongdoers. Then Satan made the two slip there, and caused them to depart the state they were in. And we said, descend in mutual antipathy, yet you will have an abode and belongings on earth for a while. Then Adam learned words from his Lord, who forgave him. For God is forgiving, merciful. Chapter 2, verse 34 through 37. The Quranic accent on Adam's fate in the final couplet spins the whole poem into a different realm of possible meaning. But whose loss was the fall of Adam, that creature of earth? Was it yours or was it mine? Adam's moral failure on earth, Iqbal suggests, mirrored even as it presaged the fall of Muslims from public power in India. And God, as well as humankind, experienced the double loss, since the fall of Adam from heaven was also an epic moment of loss for the angelic realm. Just as the splendor of paradise was reduced when Adam ceased to be part of the chorus echoing God's eternal praise, so the Star of Adam will illumine God's world less brightly when Indian Muslims are no longer at the forefront of the Ummah, or global Muslim community. It is a bold analogy to the Quran and to history. It is, perhaps, the major contribution of Muhammad Iqbal, the poet-philosopher, for his own generation and for future generations of believers, to underscore how the fates of humankind and the divine are inextricably intertwined. God has a stake in what happens below, just as the believer holds out hope for eternal bliss. The needs of the Lord and the servant are reciprocal. Neither is complete without the other. It is a cosmic tug of war that eludes the clunky prose of a theologian or the diatribes of a preacher. Only a poet-philosopher can voice it in poignant verse. Whose world is this? Yours or mine? The answer? Both.